you know, kind of a light packer, and I loved traveling on my own. I loved going. I needed to constantly be in motion, and it was like, well, clearly you're running from your own self. Duh.
Hey there, listeners. My guest today is Oriana Schwind. Oriana is one of those former journalists turned wannabe screenwriters. She lives in Los Angeles now, but she's pretty sure it's just a phase. She's a co-host of Megaphonic's own By the Bywater Tolkien podcast, and is considering reviving her old podcast about grift in America, called, fittingly enough, American Grift. She's been to the center of every single American state and lived to tell the many tales. Fittingly, as I finish editing this episode, I'm also thinking about movement. Maybe because so much of my life in the last year has been the same half dozen rooms, the same handful of people. My mind has been serving me vivid sense memories of places I've been, the sight and smell and feel of rooms across the continent, across the water, far away from me in space or in time. Maybe your mind has been traveling for you, too, in this time of constrained movement. People move around for all kinds of reasons. They might fly into a fantasy world because they're bored or because their real-life surroundings aren't giving them the things they need. They might go to a city to lose themselves. They might go into nature to find themselves, or maybe they might switch those two around. They might travel a country to discover its soul, for better or for worse. Oriana Schwind, this is your mixtape. Let's call it The Idea of a Center. Hey, Oriana, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm thrilled to be here, honestly. I was just listening to a few episodes of this podcast, and it's just such a neat idea and such a cool way to get to know cool people. So thanks for this opportunity.
Well, it's my pleasure, and that is indeed what we are here to do. If people are new to this podcast, I get an interesting person, different one every time, to bring me five songs that kind of tell me about their life. And so we're going to get to know Oriana over the next hour and a bit. But if you don't know anything about Oriana at all, well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are?
I'm certainly not a public figure of any kind. I'm Oriana Schwind. I am a kind of writer of all trades right now, now based in Los Angeles. I was in New York for a long time. I was a journalist. I primarily covered the TV industry, writing about the business of TV, interviewing a lot of very serious business people. And I got tired of doing that and have decided I want to actually make television instead. So that's what I'm doing. I am a co-host of By the Bywater, which is Megaphonic's Tolkien podcast, which is a blast. My co-hosts, Jared Pekacek and Ned Raggett, are amazing. And I had my own podcast for a little bit before. It's a lot of work to make a podcast, Michael.
No.
I don't know if you know this, but I got kind of tired of doing it for a while and took a little break. But it's called American Grift, and it's about grift in America, from the high grift that costs people millions and millions of dollars to the low, which is like sort of your Anna Delvey's.
I don't know who or what Anna Delvey is.
Oh man, she was just this like New York hipster grifter who kind of floated through New York grifting rent in loft apartments and proposing businesses and flying people to places, except having them pay for the tickets. She would pretend to like want to pay for a trip to Marrakesh and then be like, oh, can you spot me? And people would.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's very, very weird.
There's a certain sort of gutsy, like,
yeah.
I don't know how people pull that off.
I it's one of those things where, you know, the harm is no good. That's bad. But I do wish I had that confidence.
Indeed. So you were covering the TV industry as a journalist, and you had a podcast on American Grift. So you have a lot of experience with, I guess, bullshit.
Yeah. That's my whole thing, is tired of the bullshit. That was actually one of the reasons I quit. It was like after the 2016 election, I just decided I couldn't spend time talking to the guy who runs CBS about why he loves Kevin James or what. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
No, I think that's very understandable.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. That led to, like, I did this huge thing. I quit that job. I was working at Variety, and I went on a reporting trip to the geographic center of each of the 50 United States.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was horrifying.
Was this before or after the 2016 election?
It was after. It was in 2017, and it it was an adventure.
Oh man, because even in some of the, you know, air quotes blue states, the geographical center is going to be pretty rural.
Yep, exactly. It was very white. I had a guy in Michigan yell white power at me.
Woof.
My mom is from Venezuela, but she was pretty white looking. I get my coloring from my dad, who's American. I'm not even that dark, which is why it was so weird that he yelled white power at me, because it's like, oh God, okay. It was astonishing to see how many people were. I look kind of vaguely ethnic, and so I was sort of a litmus test for, like, whatever people asked me I was, because that happened all the time, or whatever people hypothesized that I was to my face, was always, oh, this is, they've never seen that type of person before. I got like, oh, are you Arab? Are you Mexican? Are you biracial? Which was always code for black. Mm. It was pretty wild. Oh, Jewish too. It was just
there's something.
I know you're not from around here, so it was. Woo, it was something.
Wow. Well, I'm interested to hear if that experience comes in at some future point during our discussion. But we have 5 songs on the plate in front of us.
Yes.
And I'm very excited to get going. What's our first song?
Our first song is Wannabe by the Spice Girls.
If you wanna be my lover, you gotta get with my friends. Make it last forever. Friendship never ends. If you wanna be my lover.
I'm so pleased.
Good.
No, I, for whatever reason, the second single from this album is always the one that I go to. I think it's because I really like the retro sci-fi video, but clearly Wannabe is the cultural touchstone.
Yes, so this song came out when I was like, I don't know, 9 or 10. What was it? 90. I should have looked this up before talking about it.
I think it's 97.
Yeah.
Then.
So I was like 10 years old growing up in suburban, borderline rural Florida. Like, it was Central Florida. It was undergoing a lot of change in the late 90s, going from this like swampy backwater to nightmare suburbia. And I was a very sheltered child in every sense of the word, but musically in this context. So I went to an elementary school. It was a Montessori school where there was only one other girl in my grade and maybe one or two below me. It was in hindsight, not great for my social development.
It's a very tiny school.
It was so small. And I don't know if you know, do you know Gabe Gonzalez?
That name is vaguely familiar.
Okay. He's like a Twitter gay? Okay. He's like a wonderful person. He's a comedian, writer. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. But we actually went to the same elementary school.
Oh, cool.
And the same middle and high school, which is odd because these were all small private schools. So it's great to see him succeed. But opportunities for friends, in particular, like girlfriends, were not like it was, they were less than plentiful, let's say. And this song was my social life. It brought me and these girls together. You know, I have this memory that I don't know how real it is. I'm questioning how real it is, given that I didn't have cable at my house. Maybe one of the other girls had cable, but the internet was not a thing. But we somehow choreographed this dance for this song at one of our birthdays. And it was like a huge deal. It was like one of the few times I felt included and girly. Because this was like the first and last time I allowed myself to unabashedly love pop music. I did not yet feel that pressure that girls like me tended to feel to not be like other girls, to not be empty-headed or silly, which of course is dumb bullshit. But like that was truly, it was like, well, no, you're not supposed to like the things that other people like. Even though that is exactly what I ended up doing, just in a very different direction.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of us fall into that trap when we're sort of preteens, right? And teens, right? Like,
yes.
You know, oh, I don't like pop music. I like this other music that is also popular, just in a slightly different way.
Yes. That was exactly it. But it was truly like this song brought so much joy, like, into my life, and it was that immediate connection, and to a certain extent, like this, it was a similar thing with like NSYNC, the Backstreet Boys, but this song was it.
Yeah, it's really interesting how you basically identify it as kind of a passport into like female society like a preteen type girl.
Oh yeah,
like it was the vehicle by which you like had these sort of friend moments in a time when you describe as kind of lacking in that somewhat, you know? So, I mean, that's a very warm, friendly thing. And I mean, that's the whole Spice Girls ethos, right?
Yes.
Like, friendship was the thesis statement of the Spice Girls.
Exactly. And they, you know, they provided this really easy way to categorize yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's, at least when I was a kid, I loved categorizing myself and other people. That's kind of essential to childhood development, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think people love it still. Like, you know, I'm an Aquarius sun and an Aries moon. It's categories.
Yep. It's true. And it's the same thing. My husband and I just watched that Netflix documentary, which was actually pretty solid, about the personality test industry. And it's true. Yeah, that instinct to categorize never really stops. Although I wish that like I enjoy the astrology categorizations. I don't like the personality test categorizations, but I wish we could replace the personality tests with just which Spice Girl are you?
Yeah. I mean, it would be just as useful. In fact, if not more, because you're self-identifying, like I self-identify as sort of sporty or, you know, as the sassy one, which is, I guess, what Ginger is. So like,
yeah. Spicy.
Yeah, like at least that's like a very broad categorization of personality, like as opposed to like, oh, I took some bullshit quiz and I got INTP and now they won't hire me.
Yep.
That's what blows me away, is that those things are used in hiring practices. That seems wrong.
Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. And my husband and I were talking about this, and he was like, you know, the only time I've ever had to take those tests were four jobs where it absolutely doesn't matter. You know, it's just your minimum wage, like primarily physical labor based jobs that he has done, that like they were the ones with the drug tests and the personality tests. Cause I've only taken personality tests after I got the job. I worked for a period of time in a management consulting firm for like 2 years. It was awful. And I did marketing for the management consulting firm, which is just as hideous as it sounds.
Oh, no.
But I was also really bad at it.
Like, this was praxis. You're being bad at it as like Marxism.
Exactly. It was, especially because the practice, as I called it, or as they called it, that I worked for, the business unit, was for health and life sciences, which meant that they told pharmaceutical companies and health insurance companies how to be more efficient, which meant like, oh, don't work on R&D for a drug to, you know, treat this kind of disease because not enough people have it.
Yeah.
To make you money. So, yeah. Anyway, that was one of the only jobs where I've taken a personality test.
You were just trying to figure out if you're like too ethical to work here.
And that kind of ended up being what happened. I simply could not, you know, but it was like I was making $50,000 a year at age, I don't know, 23 or something. And it was like, oh my God, this is the most money I'll ever have in my life.
That first flush of, oh, I have disposable income. How weird.
Oh my God. I like immediately got a one bedroom apartment. Like it was incredible. But I hated everything about my life. But that's for a later yeah. song. That's for a later song.
Let's put
song.
A pin in that.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
So we're talking about types and personalities and how the Spice Girls really scratched that itch to categorize. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have to ask which Spice Girl you identified with or was your favorite.
I was Sporty Spice.
Oh.
I was very sporty as a child. My mom was very insistent that we like be active children. I have two younger siblings, which is good. Being active is great. And I loved to run, and I was a swimmer and did gymnastics for like a hot minute, like around just before the song came out, actually. So identifying myself as a Sporty Spice Girl at age like 10 did weirdly set me on this path to be sporty as a competitive swimmer for, you know, the next decade. Almost. I guess, you know, I quit just before college because I was good, but not good enough. And like swimming in Florida is very competitive. It's a little different in like northern states or midwestern states, but you have to be pretty good in Florida to be really top ranked, and I just simply wasn't. Which is fine. It was a pretty good lesson for me in like there are just limitations. Sometimes we have limitations, and that's okay.
No, I think that's really valuable because, let's say you are, like, in the top 0.001% of guitar players. There are, like, I don't want to do the math, but there are, like, I don't know, tens of millions of people just as good at guitar as you.
Right?
And that's fine. Like, it's okay to be really good at something, but not good enough to be, like, in the Olympics.
Exactly. And that, it was interesting because I was like, a smart kid. I was one of those smart, you know, they're like, oh, you're so gifted, you're so special because you're smart, which is very damaging, I am coming to realize. But so it was good to have this one area in my life where I was, you know, I was up at 4:30 in the morning, three times a week, seven or eight practices a week. And, you know, I just kept bumping up against this limitation where I, like, you know, I could not go lower than certain times for my events, which contrasted with like success in school and academics. I was always a creative kid. I liked telling stories and, you know, making stuffed animals play act and creating these very elaborate worlds, I guess. Like my room was a world unto itself with its stuffed animals, and my brother's room was a world unto itself with its stuff. And they would have wars.
Yes. And I recognize this is very like me and my brother.
Oh, yes. How was it stuffed animals with you guys or some other kind of toy?
It was stuffed animals, but then there were other things, like we had a bag of marbles which came in.
Yes! Oh my God.
we would assign different sort of categories, so like there were only three of the marbles with like a blue pattern, so they were the wizards.
Yes!
But there were like 12 with the red pattern, so they were just soldiers. Like,
oh my God, this is, I love that this is a universal thing. Like, this is blowing my mind. We also assigned, like, you know, I think it was like my siblings, my brother is about 5.5 years younger than me, and my sister's like almost 7 years younger than me. So I took care of them a lot, and so was playing in this style with them for quite a while. And so I had started reading like Lord of the Rings and whatnot. And so that would bleed over, and we would have like the marbles would be the Silmarils,
yeah,
which are which are this like special jewel thing that, you know, is the first age of the world in Lord of the Rings revolves around these jewels. For our listeners out there who are like, what is she talking about?
No, that was gonna be my question, was like, were you reading Tolkien at this time? Because like, I hadn't read Tolkien, but I had read other fantasy literature, but like, I don't know if it's a chicken and an egg kind of a thing. Right? Like, does the fantasy come from like seeing that you can have fantasies like that? Or do you like those books because you were already doing that? I don't know.
I read a lot, and early on had shown an affinity, like well before I discovered Tolkien, for more fantastical worlds. And so for me, I think it was just me gravitating towards that. I came to Tolkien kind of later than I think other people who are devotees tend to. Like, The Hobbit was assigned reading for summer reading when I was entering seventh grade. I was entering a new school, and it became very foundational for me.
The Bronte siblings did this exact same thing that we're talking about back in the 1820s.
Yeah.
So like, Tolkien is not necessary,
no,
although it is,
no,
a, it is definitely
not
a gateway for a lot of people.
Like, it is. It tends to be sort of a natural extension, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was, yeah. I mean, we were coming up with, you know, the Great Teddy Bear Wars were well before I had ever even heard the name Tolkien. So
the Chronicles of the Great Teddy Bear Wars.
Yes, they were. Oh God. Yeah, my sister had like all the Barbies in her room. Mm-hmm. She had a very traditionally feminine room, and my brother's was like the jungle type. He loved elephants, and so there were a lot of those in there. He also had a bunk bed, so you can only imagine the shenanigans we got up to from that top bunk.
So you mentioned you were assigned The Hobbit going into grade 7. You were starting at a new school. I sensed a pivot there. Are we going to be moving into your next song now? Or?
Yes. The next song is Flying Horses by Dispatch.
Merry go round to the place where magic horses fly, and you seldom see a frown. But then I stole a ring from the flying horses, and I can't begin to explain how I stole a ring from the flying horses.
This was new to me. And my very first note is Americana ?
Yeah.
And then harmonica. Yes, Americana.
I think they're kind of problematic in hindsight. Mm-hmm. So apologies in advance. But this was, so we are actually skipping over the next large stage of my musical taste, because I think it's just kind of like, you know, it was stuff like Linkin Park and Stained, and I was a very angsty teen. There was a mm-hmm. lot of yelling in my house, and things were not great for me for like a long time. So this song, this like harmonica jam band nonsense is...
It's funny for me to hear you talk about Linkin Park and screaming, because this is very far away from that.
Exactly. So this song in particular is sort of the light at the end of that tunnel for me. Mm. I was a weird kid and not like, cute, quirky kid. I was deeply weird because of the bad socialization previously, and it took me a long time to kind of come into my own.
Yeah.
And towards the end of high school, which was when this song came into my life, I actually like started having a good group of friends who were very artsy, and because my musical taste had been so limited in the past, like we didn't as a household listen to the Beatles, or it was always just like whatever radio station my mom wanted to listen to, and she would change the song, you know, change the station if the song was too risque or she didn't like it. So my musical taste was pretty limited, and as I started nearing the time where I would be going away to college and getting out of like a not great home situation, I kind of started to open up and be receptive to music like this, which is like, it was revolutionary to me, which sounds horrible because this band is like not, you know, they're not revolutionary at all. It's
yeah, but the context you've just laid out to me, they would be like, you're in a home environment where there's not a lot of music. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of whatever the radio is playing. Music is not an important thing. Nope. It sounds like. Mm-mm. And you had the Spice Girls, and then you had like Linkin Park. So it was like, you're basically whatever the zeitgeist is giving to you that sort of fits.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're hearing music which is not necessarily in line with the zeitgeist. And I can see like contextually how this would sort of be like opening some doors.
Exactly. Yes, that is exactly it. It was, and it, like, you bring up a great point. Everything prior to this had been handed to me via the radio. So this was when like Kazaa and LimeWire and Napster were a huge thing. And so this was the first example of me choosing music to listen to. And yes, I chose it because my friends were like, this is great. Like, you know, they played it in the car or whatever. That was another thing, was like, we had vehicles of our own that we used. And some of us had CD players that, you know, do you remember the cassette tape that you plugged into the mm-hmm. CD player? Like, that was, again, revolutionary. It awakened in me a currently lifelong-ish love of folk and Americana. Mm. And this song in particular, I had one friend, shout out to Steven Vagnini. He's just a really, really great guy. He was always there for me in high school. We were there for each other, but we had these lovely afternoons where, I don't know, we would be like waiting around for something after school or maybe before school in the mornings or something. And we had this little tradition of like listening to this song and eating Little Debbie fudge rounds.
No, that's really sweet. That's a very sweet little memory.
So sweet. And it was this glimmer of hope, that mm-hmm. like, oh, this too shall pass. I can get out of here. I can get out of this. Like, I, you know, did not realize it at the time, but I was like severely depressed in middle and high school. Had just like, it was so bad. And it's still kind of astonishing to me that no adult in my life recognized this somehow. I mean, my parents were kind of busy. There were three of us. So, you know, you can kind of forgive some of that, but it is kind of weird to me in hindsight that no one noticed. But by the time this song came around, it was like, okay, we can do this. We can get out of here.
Yeah. And I mean, this song, from listening to it and going over the lyrics and so forth, it seems to be like kind of about sort of the various forms of beauty in the mm-hmm. world. And like, there are nice things in yes. the world. Like, it's very positive in that way. So
it is. And it did kind of like, Tolkien has a lot of songs and poetry in mm-hmm. his works, and it felt like an extension of that. And I was like, oh, this is like, what if you set these to music? Like, mm-hmm. oh man, it was just totally mind-blowing.
Also in my notes here, I asked myself the question, what kind of teen likes this? And then I answered it, romantic, comma, serious, question mark?
Yep, that was it. I was such, oh my god. I almost put Come What May from Moulin Rouge in here because, dude, that movie came out when I was 13, and it's to this day, like, I think my favorite movie of all time. I was such a little, I continue to be, just a totally hopeless romantic. Just yeah. All I wanted in this world was for a handsome man to sing to me.
His style, it was so vibrant and like full of emotional energy.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the melodrama of the story, like the music and the visuals, it was all mm-hmm. so much. So yeah.
And, you know, it's this sort of shallow emotionality, which is fine. Like, I'm not saying that as a critique at all. in my household, displaying of any emotion was like cause for interrogation, I guess, is probably the best way to say it. I could never display any emotion and just have that happen. It was always like, well, why are you smiling? Well, why are you so moody? And it was like, well, because I'm a teenager. That's just how this works.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And so these outlets of like, you know, the beauty of the Dispatch song, the heightened emotionality of Moulin Rouge, they are these reminders that like, no, big emotions are cool and okay, and you should embrace them. It's like great to hear people sing about beauty. I think the Dispatch song was first introduced to me and my friends by the art teacher's son.
Oh wow!
Yeah, this is just perfect. And he had this he had this long, curly, golden hair and these big brown eyes. And he played the guitar and he played this song and he had a beautiful voice. And it was just very, I felt that. I didn't have a crush on him or anything. It was just this like, oh, this like golden god has descended and is handing me this music.
It was one of those moments.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that you apologized actually when we began this song. I think because you gave me the impression that this was like problematic somehow, which I didn't research that.
The song isn't. I think the band themselves might be. They do have like they did some stuff in Africa, and they're all very white. As a jam band. You know, people come and go and whatnot. But so, yeah. Like, looking back, I'm like, was there? But it's something that I don't want to look into deeper.
What would be gained from that? I don't think you're necessarily giving them money right now, necessarily.
No. I haven't listened to them in a long time, actually. I've kind of moved on to other Americana.
You've refined your Americana tastes exactly. Further. But like, and you have these really positive memories and it served a really important function in your development. So I mean like, I don't know. I think it's fine. I don't think you need to worry about it.
it's one of those. But I just for our listeners, I do not necessarily endorse the band as this was an important song to me.
Some people when they're coming on this show, they get like kind of anxious about seeming less than cool in their song choices, and I'm like, I don't judge at all. And like, if this is what you liked when you were 14, then that is the authentic choice, and we should talk about it. Like,
there's a lot of insight to be gained. It's like, well, yeah, why did I like this? What is this? Is actually none of these were songs that I thought I would choose when you were like, hey, come on. They are all in like entirely different than what I thought I was going to pick.
Well, that's intriguing. When we're done, I want to know what the songs that you thought you'd pick would be.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we should move to the next one. Are we ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, what's number three?
So number three is The Mute by Radical Face.
Into them days I was a ghost atop my chair. My dad considered me a cross he had to bear. And in my head I'd sing apologies and stare as my mom would hang the clothes across the floor.
And I have my first note is more folksy. Yearning for travel and new experiences, then troubles with parents and home, and then double underlined indie.
It's the most indie, but you know what? I came to this song because a different song on the album was on a TV show, and not just a TV show, but the CBS procedural Elementary.
Oh, wow.
Which...
that wasn't how I thought you'd end that sentence.
Nope. Shout out to Elementary, by the way. That show is the Sherlock Holmes adaptation that Sherlock wishes. It could be. It's actually the superior of the two. Fight me, internet. Actually, I think this is a much more widely held belief these days than maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. Anyway, the time period, we're kind of skipping over college. But so after college, I moved to New York to be a magazine writer, LOL, because I graduated college in 2008. And
oh no,
we all know what happened.
Literally the worst year yep. to graduate college.
Just real bad times. I went to journalism school, not a thing I really recommend now, but I went to Northwestern. And so like I was able to get internships, but of course, as the financial crash was happening, everything just died. Like media just died. But I did eventually like claw my way into the magazine industry, weirdly. So I'm in New York, and I'm an adult, like a real adult. I'm having to do adult things. And I was actually having to confront for the first time the fact that my childhood had actually done lasting damage. Like it wasn't just, well, everyone's mom yells at them, like, you know, everyone's mom is really tough on them. And so the song kind of helped me realize like, oh, this was like kind of fucked up. And to be a child is to sort of feel unheard and as though you cannot communicate with the adults around you. But that's not necessarily the norm. Usually people have adults in their life that they feel they can communicate with. So this song was actually very helpful in helping me realize that. But it was also a difficult time for me. And I really related to this need to simply vanish and go away and sort of release people from the burden of my own existence. If that's not too dark.
No, well, you're allowed to be as dark as you want here. But like, I completely understand that. I think because children and teenagers are or feel so resilient that like you sort of like, okay, well, like that was shitty when I was 16, but I'm 22 now and things are good now. So like,
yes,
doesn't affect me. And I was like, no, yes, it clearly does. You carry that with you the rest of your life and you're going to be feeling that trauma when you're like 45. Sorry. Like
that is exactly it. That is exactly it. That was exactly my attitude in my early 20s. I was like, I can't tell you how many shrinks I told like, you know, yeah, my mom was kind of mean to me, but like, whatever, it doesn't matter. And, you know, 5 years later, it was like, oh, that mattered a great deal. And it still does to this day. Yeah. Okay. All right. Like, you know, it really, you're so dead on. It's only all this time later, like realizing how thoroughly this sort of self-destructive urge had penetrated my everyday life.
It structures the lens through which you view reality.
Like, absolutely. And it's so interesting to look back and see, like, I was pretty successful in my journalism career. Like, I was working at TV Guide and then got a better paying and like just better overall job at a place called the International Business Times, then went to Variety. And it was, you know, I was like, oh, wow, I'm like doing well. But I was clearly going through a lot of shit that I just refused to recognize at the time. And even when I was realizing it kind of at the time, like the protagonist of the song, I didn't quite have the language to get it out there, you know. And he's talking about, if you listen with your ears, I can't get in. And my actions at the time were all that of a person who was very self-destructive, very depressed, really going through it. But my words were not like that for a while, at least.
The other thing you said was about, I'll see if I can remember the exact way you phrased it. It was about sort of yearning to relieve people of the burden of like
my own existence. Yeah.
So I'm thinking about, okay, you grew up in this, the way you described it as sort of rural transitioning into suburban nightmares, like from one gothic to another in Florida.
Yeah.
And like, and then you're like, you're in New York, which is like where people go to reinvent themselves, mm-hmm. but also to disappear into a crowd.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting, people who go from small communities and want the huge, huge city into which they can kind of dissolve themselves.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Because you can throw yourself into the crowd, into work, into, you know, anything you want in a large city. Now that the area I grew up in, because I can't even use the word town, I brought my husband there. We had to go to my parents' house to buy a car off them. And it was his first time, not in Florida, not even in the Orlando area, but like his first time seeing that particular brand of suburbia, which is there's no town.
Mm.
Town does not exist. There is no like town center. There's no, it's all just sprawl. Like even LA, which is where we live now, has there are neighborhoods that like it's a lot of sprawl, but like you there's downtown LA, it's a collection of cities, and it's a little more like, oh, this is sort of the downtown district or something. But that just I started doing the Centerville project, which was that 7-month reporting project to the geographic center of each state, I was like, oh, wow, like towns are a real thing, because I had grown up in Florida. I went to college in Chicago, or rather like a suburb of Chicago. I went to Northwestern, and people from Chicago get mad if you say you went to college in Chicago and it's like you went to Northwestern. They're like, that's not in Chicago. It's like, okay, I'm sorry.
Is it Evanston? I can't
yes,
remember.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Oh my God. It's like, okay, fine. And Evanston did have like, it was a town. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first experience of a town. But then it was just New York. And so realizing that like, oh, most places town is a thing. Like mm-hmm. that was crazy to see.
I'm seeing here like that the feeling I got from this, so indie double underlined, I said,
yeah,
but also yearning for travel and new experiences.
Oh, yes.
And we're talking about like the Centerville project was 2017, so I'm assuming a little bit later on, but like post you leaving Florida, it seems like you did kind of want to drift, I guess.
Yeah. To go, like I was very much like a person on the go. I never really decorated apartments
mm-hmm.
With my own stuff. I was always, you know, kind of a light packer, and I loved traveling on my own. I loved going. I needed to constantly be in motion, and it was like, well, clearly you're running from your own self. Duh.
These things are so obvious in hindsight.
I know. It's just like, oh, this is so painfully obvious. I feel like the Centerville project was actually kind of the culmination of this period.
Mm.
Because, you know, even again, as I like, I was the TV news editor at Variety. It was kind of everything I had set out to do before I even went to college. And none of it mattered. I was like, oh God, okay, this is going to be bad. And so I gave in to that instinct to go, not run away necessarily, although I kind of was running away. It was a bad breakup. It was like a couple years before, but we were still kind of in each other's orbit, and it was bad. Mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking about.
Those protracted things that can take years. Like,
oh my God. Just way too long, still too enmeshed in each other's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so that instinct to just pack up and go. And so I like quit my job. I went to Portland, Oregon, and had like a sublet there for a couple months, and started doing the Centerville stuff from there, basically.
Mm.
I still can't believe I did it. I did all of them. I did all 50. I went to Alaska. I went to Hawaii. Alaska was like the third one I did, actually.
The geographical center of Alaska. Holy crap.
Well, so there is a caveat here. I did not make it to the actual geographic center of some of the places because like Alaska is too remote and the
so you need to like hire a helicopter.
Yeah, like. That was like it's in Denali. There's no anything there. So real like the purpose of the project was to talk to people was to see who is in the center of each state, why are they there, because often like you had a fair number of cities capitals but also just absolutely nothing, and it was like, well, what are you doing here, like have you always lived here? And so I generally went to the city or town closest to the geographic center. And in some cases it was like Fairbanks was as far as I got in Alaska because there just isn't anything out there. Nevada, it was like
a gas station or something.
Basically, it was Austin, Nevada, which is hilarious to me. And it was a town of like 200 or 180 people. And it's on a stretch of US Route 50, which is called the loneliest road in America. You're like 90 miles from the next town.
Imagine growing up there. Wow.
I can't. Like, it was so weird. And it was, I had this really lovely, I ate at a diner there. You know, a typical like diner in Trump country, but like that was just what was there. But I did have this lovely woman who was kind of older, who was the waitress there, and we were chatting, and I was like, "Yeah, why do people? You know, why you came here from somewhere else?" Because she had told me she moved there from Oregon, and she was like, "Yeah, I just, you know, I'm looking for a place to die." And I was like, "Oh my god, what? It is 8:30 in the morning."
So, I'm sorry, I'm laughing so hard.
It's so weird.
What an answer! Like, I really admire that in a way. Like,
right? She did not give a fuck, and I took that energy to heart, really, because that was like towards the end of my journey. And I really needed that, actually.
Hey, everyone. Oriana and I talked a lot more about her Centerville project, and she has so many more stories about visiting the geographical center of each 50 of the states, but I had to cut them for reasons of time. I've compiled those clips, and if you are a member of our Patreon, which costs as little as $2 a month, you can hear them as bonus material at patreon.com/megaphonic. And if you've been considering joining up and supporting the network, this might be a nice time to do it, because, wow, lots of stories.
I could not get this published as a book. It was amazing the number of like lit agents and book publishing industry people I talked to about this who were like, "Oh no, this doesn't sound like a book." I was like, "What are you talking about?"
That's unbelievable to me.
I wrote a profile of each place with all the quotes from the people I talked to, and you're telling me this isn't a book?
Like it has a clear elevator pitch.
Right?
It's coming at a moment when America is doing a lot of, like, self-reflection.
Yeah!
The New York Times could not get enough of fucking Trump diners in, like, middle America. Like,
just truly, truly astonishing.
So I had two questions, and you just answered one of them, was that what came of this? So clearly you were trying to pitch it as a book.
Yeah.
Is there some way that people might want more can like engage with it now if they type it into Google or whatnot?
I did it as like a Patreon thing. People could subscribe on Patreon, and they would get the profiles and vary, you know, depending on the tier, they would get extra stuff that I was writing. Well, that doesn't exist in public view, but some of them do exist in public view. I tried to turn this material into like 8 different things. I was pitching it as a book. I was pitching it as like an article series. Like, I knew an editor at Vice who had been my editor at the International Business Times. And I was like, "Do you want this? This feels very Vicey. Like, you know, girl goes around the country on her own." So much of this genre, the like, I bummed around the country for a while, is just white dudes.
Yeah.
It's all white dudes.
Mm-hmm. Like this exists. You have a twist on it, but this is a genre. This sort of like exploring America's soul by like road trip.
This is like no different than that guy who went to all the McDonald's and sat and talked with them. And he's got a big fat book deal. And I realized, oh, because he's a middle-aged white guy. Why are we so interested in his experiences? Like, they're very different from mine. That was the other thing, was I did publish some of these. I published a sort of capstone a few months after I finished on Medium, which was where I had published some of the profiles that I had done in order to drum up interest in the Patreon. It ended up being featured by Medium, which meant a lot more people read it than would usually, which is great, but also unfortunate. The feedback was like split between, well, it was mostly actually like white guys telling me I was wrong that I was too pessimistic about America. And I was like, I mean, you know, there was like a guy from Germany who was like, I went around America and none of this type of thing happened to me. And I was like, gosh, I wonder why.
From Germany, you say?
I know, it was like, oh, okay, all right.
Wow.
I'm going to let that lie. It's too on the nose. I refuse to engage. I don't know, man. If you're listening to this and you want to, I did put it into a kind of an ebook for the patrons. And, you know, fuck it. If you're listening to this and you want that, I don't know, it's like 100 pages or something. If you want these essays, I don't know, DM me on Twitter or something and I'll just send it to you. It's a big file, but I'll get it to you. Like, fine.
And these ones on Medium, they're still up there?
They are still up there, yeah.
Yeah, I'll link some in the show notes if you don't mind.
Yeah. I'll send you some links.
Do we feel ready to move to our next song?
Yes, okay. Yes. We have spent so much time. Oh my God.
So what do we have?
Being Alive, specifically the Raul Esparza version. I accept no other version of this song from the musical company, which is, of course, by Stephen Joshua Sondheim.
But alone is alone, not alone. Somebody crown me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody let me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive.
So this is clearly from a musical. We spent some time in sort of like Americana, folksy, indie kind of area, and now we are in a different country altogether.
Very, very.
So why don't you tell me your history with this song?
So I have, like, beginning kind of with Moulin Rouge, that was like my introduction to musicals, which I feel like is kind of a heresy in the musical theater community. But I love musicals. I did musicals as a kid. Around the Spice Girls time, actually. and then my voice changed and I stopped being good at singing, but I always loved musicals, and I have always it's very cliche, but I love Stephen Sondheim. I did almost pick a Jason Robert Brown song for this, but with Jason Robert Brown, who is also a musical guy, writer, composer, with him it's like kind of the whole show rather than a single song. But so the musical company is from the 70s. It's basically about a 35-year-old man living in New York who has these very shallow relationships with everyone in his life, but specifically romantic relationships. He's the only single member of his friend group. And the end of the first act has him singing a song called Marry Me a Little, where a friend of his is kind of having doubts on her wedding day. And he's like, marry me instead, you know, marry me a little, marry me just enough. And it's very like, let's, you know, it's still that sort of very shallow. He's like, well, I'm ready to get married, but, you know, only a little. And then Being Alive is the, you know, spoiler alert for the musical company. It is the end of the show, and it is where Robert, the protagonist, finally, like, grows the fuck up and realizes he is ready for commitment. And it's not just commitment to another person, to a relationship, but it's a commitment to yourself, to life. And post Centerville was my Being Alive moment. I decided, like, the whole rest of my life I was looking for an exit, essentially, and I decided I was no longer going to do that. I was going to commit to being alive.
I'm glad that you've just summarized that, because that's what a lot of my notes are.
Yes. yes.
And it's like, restraint being broken, ? And then quotation, force me to care.
Yes. I throw myself into relationships, and thankfully I've found a relationship to throw myself into for the rest of my life. But there was afterward, like, the aftermath of my relationship that had ended in 2014 or 2015, depending. It was another one of those stupid long
these protracted affairs.
Sure is. Was like, fuck this, no more. Like, you know, I can't deal with someone, you know, sitting in my chair and ruining my sleep. So I finally got over that, and this song. So there have been a number of productions of this show throughout the years, and the Rule Esparza one is the perfect one. It is, as far as I am concerned, the only one. There was a televised version of it that was like Neil Patrick Harris as Bobby, and Stephen Colbert as one of the other guys. And it's good, but this, no one does it like Raul, I don't think. And
I remember at the sort of big power note at the very end of the song, there's a certain roughness to his voice, which I found very affecting. It was very good.
Yeah. Did you watch the YouTube video at all?
No, I only listened to it.
I do recommend, because it is just, I mean, it's him on the stage. He starts out like playing the piano and then gets up and, but yeah, it's deeply affecting. And, you know, I had heard this song before and been like, yeah, good for you, Bobby, coming around. But it wasn't until like a little after 2017 that I like actually internalized what he was singing about.
I've written down here, relationships, scary work, vitalizing.
Yep.
Like it really is that they are scary and frustrating, and they take work, particularly if you're a person who is content in their own company and content on their own. It's sort of like very tempting to be like, I don't need to do this.
Yeah.
But like, at some point you're probably going to get smacked in the face with the fact that really you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just romantic relationships too. I realized that a lot of my friendships, and I think this is true for a lot of people in their 20s, were kind of these shallow, not like the most shallow, but like there could be more depth there. And a lot of it was based on kind of shared likes and shared dislikes. And there's a sort of bantery basis for it. And this is around the time where I realized, partly because of Centerville, that being a snarky, smart asshole is not a way to live in the world.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's so much more important to simply be a kind, genuine person. And that's going to make your life better. It'll be harder at times, but it's just going to be better.
Yeah. I've had plenty of friends in my 20s and so forth, but like, to open yourself up to like a deeper connection, like, is not necessarily easy.
No.
That's what I hear in this song, is this character doing that work of like breaking himself down and opening himself up.
Yeah.
Totally tying it into this, to the story of your life that you told us so far. So you come back from this trip around the country were
just like, shattered. I was total, Michael, I was shattered by that. Like, I was just totally broken.
I mean, I'm not surprised to hear you say that because, like, first of all, what a time in history to be doing that. Yep. Second of all, like, that is just a lot to take on. A lot of experiences, a lot of, like, uncertainty and stress, just one after the another. It's not like you did 25 and then you took a year off and then did another 25. Like, you must have been exhausted physically and emotionally.
Absolutely. And I think it was that, like, just being totally broken down that was like, oh, all right, this is the time. This is not a subtle choice.
Musical subtle?
But this is also like, I think also like more and more I find myself feeling that subtlety is overrated. I'm like, no, let's just get to the point. I just like my husband and I watched the original Godzilla movie the other day and I was like, yeah, because they're not subtle about anything at all in that movie, but it works. It works so well. They just come right out and are like, yeah, it's bad. Nuclear war is bad. Weapons are of mass destruction are bad. And I'm like, yeah. We don't need to infer that.
That's very fair. I'm sort of picturing you coming back from this trip and you're having your being alive Stephen Sondheim moment, I guess. And you go back to New York?
I went back to New York. I left New York in April of 2017, on April 1st, actually. I was like, no, this isn't a joke, I promise. I'm doing this.
It just
this.
Worked out
yeah,
this way.
Like, this was when my lease was ending, so... But I was not sure. I was like, well, maybe I'll live in Portland, Oregon for, you know, a period of time. I was like, well, maybe I'll find one of these centers will be a place I want to live. And no.
don't want to hang out with the lady in Nevada who's there to die.
Nope. I'm not. And that was actually, I was like, oh yeah, I'm not ready to do. Oh, okay. Well, like,
that's an important lesson to take away.
It was. I was like, oh, I miss New York. I had never anticipated missing New York. And what's kind of weird is I went back to New York and was like, I'm gonna live here for the rest of my life. And then as I was trying to figure out what I was gonna do with my life, like, I didn't want to go back to journalism, but I have no other skills. All I can do is write. That's kind of the only thing I can do. And I was like, well, how do I make money? You know, which is how I fell into, like, I do a lot of copywriting now, and I absolutely hate it. I can say that, I can admit that, because no one I work for will ever listen to this.
I'll leave it in then.
Yeah, that's fine. So I was kind of casting around, and I was looking, actually, it was almost spite. The Centerville book idea was going nowhere. I kept, you know, I worked on like two or three book proposals with agents, and like at the end of the process, each time they were like, you know, maybe this isn't a book. And it's like, well, what is it then? Like, it was unfathomable to me that I could have done this thing, this unbelievably huge undertaking, and not have anything to show for it in terms of like a thing out in the world other than just my own little blog.
Yeah.
I had gotten a lot of TV writer contact. Like, I became friends with a decent number of people who write for television. Like, a couple of them were patrons, and I was like, could this be a TV show? And they were like, anything can be a TV show. Why don't you try? Like, and so I started writing a pilot, and like the first draft of it was just garbage because it was basically just me. And I was like, no, you need to like turn this into a story with a different character.
Like they say, shitty first drafts, right? Like,
yeah,
it's important. That's part of the process.
It is important. And so, but I realized while writing it, I was like, oh God, I really like doing this. And then the final season of Game of Thrones happened.
And I can anticipate what you're going to say, but please go on.
And I was like, could do this.
Yep.
I could definitely do this.
I love it.
Right? It's just...
How many people have been motivated by that moment where I could do better than this? What
so
the fuck?
Many. So many people. I can only imagine that that's like, you know, this was an oversaturated industry in the first place, but I can only imagine the flood of people. And I rewrote like the final episodes entirely and was like, oh, I love doing this.
Mm.
I love this form. It brings me joy to get into these characters and figure out a way to have the plot of the show be driven by character. And it took me back to playing Teddy Bear Wars.
Yeah, absolutely. I can absolutely see this as like,
yeah,
like a return.
Yeah. So, but like, you know, you can't really be a screenwriter in New York. You can't write for TV in New York unless you work for SNL. And while I can be a funny person sometimes, I am not a comedy writer. There's mm-hmm. a very, I feel like there aren't enough people who understand that distinction.
Oh, I mean, to me, that seems like a very easy thing to understand because like,
you would think
like, it's so hard to be yeah. funny on purpose.
Oh my God. I don't think I've ever managed it in my life. Yeah. So, and now I live in LA, which is a bummer. Mm. I really hate LA.
Well, you've not been out there for that long. Perhaps no, it will grow on you.
That's true. And maybe, like, I like the nature. I love the nature. I love mountains. And that actually kind of brings us to our next song, if you want to keep
yeah.
if you want to talk about
that. I was
about
to say, it sounds to me like we ought to get to your final song. So what do we have?
We have Remember the Mountain Bed, which is, the lyrics are by Woody Guthrie, and Wilco and Billy Bragg took those lyrics and turned it into a song.
Across many states just to stand here now, my face all hot with tears. I cross city and valley, desert and stream to bring my body here. History and future blaze bright in me, and all my joy and pain go through my head on our mountain bed where I smell your hair again.
It is kind of funny. So this is actually kind of me reclaiming this song from an earlier period. So my first boyfriend in college was the one who introduced me to Wilco and to this song. And it's also kind of funny because my husband's name is Steve, and that was also the name of that first boyfriend. I like to joke that, you know, it was just, oh, it was the wrong Steve. That's all.
You know, these little mix-ups, they happen.
Yeah, it's the universe just having a little fun joke. I do. So, you know, I grew up in Florida, and that's the flattest place on earth.
Yep.
Basically, I don't remember seeing a mountain. I mean, I had not seen the Rocky Mountains until doing Centerville.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I had seen East Coast mountains, but those aren't real mountains. Come on.
they're all subdued.
Yeah,
and restrained.
They're and I like I love them. They're beautiful, but they're you know, to call them a mountain feels a bit of a misnomer.
Mm-hmm. You need to have snow on top all year round.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. So this song like started out as kind of traumatic, honestly. It's a beautiful song. I hope you all listen to it, but I like my clearest memory of this song is playing it on repeat while on a plane to visit that first boyfriend. We went to school together, but he was in New York doing an internship, and we had this enormous fight as soon as I got there. That was entirely my fault.
Oh no.
And I was listening to the song while, you know, we were kind of in our separate corners, just crying my little heart out. But this album, like, I love this album. It's Mermaid Avenue, volumes 1 and 2. And it turns out that my now husband loves this album. And we went on our first little trip together. It was just a weekend away to like Vermont. And I think we hadn't, we'd been together like less than 2 months or just over 2 months. And he put the song on in the little cabin we were in. And I started singing it to him, which is not a thing, or, you know, singing along with the song, but kind of to him. And it's just not a thing that I do normally. I love musicals, but I don't sing, certainly not in front of other people. And he was enchanted, and I realized I was gonna marry this person.
Aww.
So reclaiming the song was kind of really important. And now I did marry that guy. I did marry him just a month ago today.
Congrats. Yay. Oh, that's really sweet. And I mean, the whole idea of you kind of singing this song, which has this previous sort of trauma associated to it.
Yeah.
And if you're a person who, like, you can't stop me singing. I sing all the fucking time. But like, that's so if you're great. Someone who generally doesn't sing and you're singing it to, like, that's such a vulnerable thing to do.
Oh my God. Yes.
It's interesting because when I was listening to this last night and I was like sort of trying to piece together my thoughts on it and so forth, I have a happy ending ?
Yeah.
Because it's interesting because like, so the story, like there's, I don't know, like there's like 9 verses. Like it's,
there, oh my God, it's so long.
It's like
so
a pretty long song. Like,
yeah.
And I was like, it seems to me like, okay, so it's a love song of sorts, but it seems to be, I don't know if it's sort of going back to the mountain to sort of like recharge and reconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the ending, I almost felt like it was almost a bit of a twist ending. Because it's, he talks about going back to like
his woman and child. Yeah.
This place is visiting. Is it a person? Is it like a what is happening in
what
this
is
song?
Happening?
Yeah, I don't know.
it is one of those. It's like it's very long, and there's a lot happening, which is very kind of Woody Guthrie. Who is like it's beautiful, but it is kind of like, well, you kind of just have to go with it, and I wasn't that kind of person previously. I was very over analytical, and I was like, well, everything has, like, I have to know what every word of the song means, and I have to like every part of every line needs to apply to me somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very childish. and this was kind of the song where I was, like, Dispatch, that Flying Horses song, kind of laid the groundwork for being like, just it's pretty. It's pretty. That's all that matters. Like, there's this beautiful imagery in there, and trees are great. We love trees, and we love mountains, and the smell of your hair, like, great. It's all just... You know, you've got the, it's like, oh, okay, we're bittersweet, we're beautiful. All right, that's fine.
I mean, the nature thing was the other hook that I sort of had.
Yeah.
I know because, like, we follow each other on social media and we both have podcasts on the same network that, like, you went to see the giant redwoods, right?
Sequoias.
I'm so sorry. Some big trees. You saw some big California trees.
Some big fucking trees.
But yeah, like, you went to see some big trees, mm-hmm. and you just mentioned how the nature in LA is, or that part of California is, like, one of the things you do like about it.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of thinking about this song as kind of being about the nature as that mm-hmm. sort of guiding force or that emotional anchor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was, you know, so the boyfriend I had had before my husband was very not into doing things.
Oh, no.
And like being in New York and not having a car, opportunities for nature were pretty limited. So for, you know, it wasn't until Centerville that like I got into, I'm not like an outdoors person, but like I'd never been camping or anything. And Steve, my husband, grew up in pretty rural Maine, and has been camping his whole life and very outdoorsy, but not in like an annoying Pacific Northwest way, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And like, I apologize to anyone from the Pacific Northwest who is an outdoorsy type who might feel
so
offended.
Sorry. You're
by
probably
this.
You're probably a perfectly lovely person.
it's the same with any other sort of like thing when it becomes like a capital L lifestyle.
Right? Yes.
That like, yeah, that's the thing.
That Patagonia lifestyle, basically.
Pretty much anything can become like that if you do it too much and become too like loud about it.
Exactly.
So.
But it is, you know, getting into a relationship with Steve was like, oh, there's an opportunity here for me to like actually further like doing Centerville. I got to see some beautiful places and I got to actually like I bought hiking boots and, you know, went into the Rockies and did all sorts of cool outdoorsy things. Like I went to Glacier National Park and had a transcendent afternoon there. But, you know, again, going back to New York, I was like, well, city, and I love city. But I also do love mountains and nature. And, so I was able, like, you know, he has all the gear. And so we were able to, you know, we went camping, we went hiking, you know, and it's one of the foundations of our relationship is going out to these beautiful places. And it's nice to have this song kind of sum that up.
I feel like that's probably a good place
to wrap
up. Oh my
God, yeah, that's yep.
Is there anything you hoped we'd get into that we didn't?
No. We have done everything.
Wonderful. I love being a completionist. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. If people are interested in you as a podcast host or your writings or just your media presence, how might they go about finding you?
On Twitter, I am at Schwinter, S-C-H-W-I-N-D-T-E-R. Ditto on Medium. Some of the Centerville stuff is there. By the Bywater is on Megaphonic and is available via basically any podcast app or, you know, wherever you want to listen to it.
Where fine podcasts are found.
Right. Where so many fine podcasts are found. American Grift, which is still on hiatus, but hopefully I will bring it back sometime in the next couple months or something. It is also on whatever podcast app you want to use. And it's fun. There's like 10 episodes and they're pretty fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's and I'll have links to basically all those things in the show notes for your ease of clicking. So
God forbid.
So thank
people
you.
Have to.
We have to make things very easy for people.
It's true. That's true. I'm not Googling any of it. Come on.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, that was great.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you.
Many thanks to Oriana for sharing her life and music with us, as the Great Ship mixtape continues on its voyage. For more information about the episode and for links to the things we discussed, you can find the show notes at megaphonic.fm/mixtape/48. This Is Your Mixtape is a proud part of the Megaphonic Podcast Network. You can support the network by going to patreon.com/megaphonic. For as little as $2 a month, you'll be able to hear bonus material, including more about Oriana's experiences visiting the geographic center of every state. In addition to podcasts, Megaphonic has become a streaming micro-empire. You can watch Chris from It's Just a Show solve crosswords, or me play Stardew Valley, or various permutations of the whole gang play Jackbox at switch.tv/megaphonicfm. You can drop me a note on Twitter at Earl King or at This Is Your Mix, or via email at mixtape@megaphonic.fm. My name is Michael Collins, and thank you for joining me on today's journey.